questions of the folks on our panel. So the Citizen Review Committee, for folks that are not aware, we're an 11-member body. We have a couple of different responsibilities, but our overall goal is to improve police accountability, promote higher standards of police services, and increase public confidence. There's definitely lots of flaws in these systems, but that's what we're here to talk about. And we're trying to leverage this opportunity to make some real change. And so we're trying to lead some community discussion so that people can be informed on what's going on. They can have some good context, and we can start to work towards those solutions. Also on the CRC, we, in addition to gathering community concerns, we help to develop policy recommendations. We review and advise the independent police review and the internal affairs. And then we hear appeals from complainants and officers and publicly report those findings. So that's a big difference that we have compared to other oversight bodies, is that we are a part of that appeals process for complaints. So that's just a gist so that you all are aware. I'm gonna turn it over to Vadim, and Vadim is gonna lead us through a bunch of different discussion topics with our panelists, and I guess we're going to start with intro of our panelists. Yes?
Yes. Hello, everybody. My name is Vadim Mazursky, and I'm the Vice Chair of the Citizen Review Committee. My pronouns are he, him, and his. The death of George Floyd in Minneapolis has prompted renewed calls to address brutality and racial disparities in American policing. But the path for transformation has a long history. In 1967, President Johnson formed a commission to improve relations between the police bureau and Black communities. In 94, the acquittal of three officers who beat Rodney King resulted in Congress giving the Justice Department the authority to investigate police practices that violated civil rights protections. And since 2013, Black Lives Matter movement has made police violence a pressing national and local issue. Yet, as recent events demonstrate, we still have a long way to go. There have been calls to defund or abolish the police bureau, but what does that mean? And what is the best way to move forward to ensure equal treatment and safety for all? And so we have this evening a panel of experts, community leaders, organizers, and people with hands-on expertise to talk about how to change policing in America and in Portland specifically in the context of the broader concerns about systemic racism and inequality. I'm humbled to be in this virtual space with so many individuals who have dedicated their lives to serving others and helping people lead better, more dignified lives. Although the first part of this dialogue will focus on input from panel members, I encourage the public to post comments using the Zoom chat feature or to email comments to crc@portland.gov. We'll capture and review these comments. And in the meantime, though, I'll ask each individual to briefly introduce themselves in alphabetical order. Let's see. Tiffany Hammer, I believe you're the first person here in alphabetical order. You might have to unmute yourself so everyone is muted. And then please go ahead.
Thank you, Vadim. Going first, I'm a little nervous. My name is Tiffany Hammer, and I'm the public safety co-chair for the Goose Hollow Foothills League in downtown Portland's Neighborhood Association. But today I will represent myself as a person of the Goose Hollow community.
And next we have Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes Jr.
Yes, I'm Dr. Leroy Haynes Jr. I'm the chairperson of the Bonner Ministry Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, representing 25 different community organizations, and been on this work of police reform since 2003.
Good to see you, Reverend. We have Mr. Scott Kerman.
Thank you, Vadim. I'm Scott Kerman. I'm the executive director at Blanchet House of Hospitality. We have multiple programs in the Portland metro area, including our main facility in Old Town Chinatown, where we provide meals and shelter for homeless and food insecure individuals.
And if I can please remind everybody, we've been asked to have everybody say their pronouns.
Thank you for reminding me. My pronouns are
he and
his.
He and she.
Thank you, sir. And then we have Mr. Alex Rodriguez.
Hey, I'm Alex Rodriguez. I am a homeless resident of Old Town, a street vendor, and a member of the outreach team for the Old Town OTCA. And pronouns is he and him.
And Liz Sauer.
Hi, my name is Liz Sauer. I'm the communications manager for Basic Rights Oregon. We're a statewide advocacy organization for the LGBTQ community. And my pronouns are she, her, and hers.
Mr. Daryl Turner.
Hi, I'm Officer Daryl Turner. I'm a 29-year veteran of the Portland Police Bureau, and I'm the president of the Portland Police Association, and my pronouns are he and him.
And we have Ms. Sabina Erdesh.
Hi, my name is Sabina Erdesh. I am currently the president of the Lentz Neighborhood Association, the co-chair of the East Portland Action Plan. I'm also the executive director of East Portland Collective, and I serve on Prosper Portland's Community Budget Advisory Committee. I live in Lentz, and I am the mom of a school-age child who is enrolled in Portland Public Schools, but my views tonight are my own. I don't speak on behalf of any organization. Just based on my experience doing work for those organizations, as well as being a community member, a neighbor, an immigrant, and a mom.
Thank you. And for the time being, Mr. Mark Wells is the last panelist.
Hi, good evening, everybody. Again, my name is Mark Wells. I'm here representing the Public Safety Action Coalition. We're a group that strives to be the voice for the community, interacting with government, nonprofits, and local businesses. And we want to support programs that reduce crime and create a safe and clean, welcoming environment. Thank you for letting me participate tonight.
Thank you, everybody. I'm going to send some links to three other individuals that I believe are still awaiting to join the call, and hopefully we'll have a few more individuals join us in a minute.
Yeah,
thank you very much for everybody for participating. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. I have a series of topics to cover today, and hopefully we'll get to all of them, but it's more important that we hear from all perspectives. If the panel members can use the Zoom raise hand function, or barring that, just raise their hand on the screen, I'll do my best to call on each individual in turn. So today we might have a lot of constructive criticism for the Portland Police Bureau and elected officials in Portland. So let me start off with an icebreaker question. What, in your experience, has PPB been doing well?
I don't know if they can use the raise hand feature, but I see Alex has their hand raised.
Okay. Alex?
Some things I have been seeing that they've been doing well is I've seen a lot of individual members of the police have good relationships with some of the people that I've seen on the streets, as far as being, I guess, it's trauma-informed response to people. I've seen several times where there's a specific lady in Old Town. Oh, she's homeless. She has Tourette's and will call out quite a bit. And I've seen plenty of other people tell her to shut up when there's who also live in the streets, when an officer pulls up next to her, gets out of the car, and then helps defend her just by informing people that she has Tourette's, and there's no reason to treat her like that. Even simple things like that, I've seen definitely on the streets. I've definitely been appreciative.
Okay. And if we can't use the raise hand function within the panelists, if anybody has anything to add, please just raise your hand. I'll be glad to call on you or unmute yourselves, and we'll. Can we just unmute everyone in the panel? I don't think there'll be too much people speaking over one another.
Well, they can unmute themselves, Vadim. So right. They can, when they want to speak, they should just unmute.
Dr. Haynes, I see you unmuted yourself.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to say I think there's been a substantive improvement in the policies and also in the training of the Bureau.
Vadim, I'll just shoot in really quickly. It's in the news a lot. It's hard to see, though. But on June 27th, if anybody didn't catch it, there was a gentleman experiencing a mental health crisis. He was armed with a rifle. Portland police showed up and were able to, you know, de-escalate the situation and get him the help that he needed safely without any force used. And I think that is what we strive for every single call. So it's good to see that every day Portland Police is doing good work. And I think that call highlights the dangers of the job, the challenges of policing, and the outcome that I think everybody we want to strive for every call like that.
And Sabina, I see you have your hand raised as well.
Thank you. Well, you know, my experience with police is from trying to obtain a stalking protective order, attending protests, and then most recently, being held at gunpoint in my neighborhood. Can you hear me okay? Sometimes my speaker's not working okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And right now, I would say, you know, considering the backdrop for this conversation is that we're learning from the news, and some of us have also seen with our own eyes that right now our local police are collaborating with federal marshals to suppress freedom of speech and to attack protesters and deploy military-grade munitions on peaceful protesters for 47 straight days now. I personally find it hard to focus on what they're doing right. Donovan Labella is fighting for their life in the hospital after they were shot at a protest Saturday night while they were holding a boombox. I have journalist friends like Beth Nakamura with The Oregonian, who's one of the people, one of the journalists who have held up their press IDs and got hit in the back with batons when they got, you know, swept with protesters, even though they identified themselves and they didn't try to be in the way in any way, shape, or form. So I do hear what, you know, the examples that other people have given, and I think sometimes it can be helpful on, hey, what are the things that we do want to see and that we are seeing? And it's important to acknowledge those. But I also think it's worth acknowledging these very serious issues that have brought us here tonight in the first place.
Thank you, Sabina. Okay. So let me move on to the meat and bones of this conversation. Some topics which I hope we'll get some good input and we'll use this information to present a report to the city commissioner, who is the mayor, as well as the other commissioners. So my next topic of conversation is that.
Vadim, can we get to Tiffany first before you move on?
Oh, hey, Tiffany, please go ahead.
I would like to speak on that question of what police have been doing right. And I'm gonna go back to, if you all can hear me, being someone downtown Portland for probably the last 15 years, there's been ups and downs with crime. And I know serious crime started to drop down in 2018. And 2019, to me, being down there, I felt that police did a good job of decreasing serious crime. And we did have, in the Goose Hollow area, this is me speaking on behalf of myself, we did have a lot of mental health crisis situations over the past year where we had hostage situations. We do have hotspot areas that required more of the NERT team, the neighborhood response team, and I felt like they came in with compassion and they had the ability to triage severe mental health issues, also severe drug addiction issues. Unfortunately, a homeless situation that's in crisis as well, and I feel like they were able to navigate through that in the last few years. And I also want to make aware that in 2017, I was a crime victim, unfortunately, being downtown, just unlucky that way. I thought they did a very good job with victims out there, because right now you'd never hear stories of victims anymore. They get kind of squashed out there. And the police are the front lines out there that are handling not only all those underfunded programs that should support all of our people out there, like mental health and drug addiction and treatment programs. There's just not enough money out there in management. And so victims kind of get in the lowest category in my eyes. And I thought that police do a really good job of making sure that everybody's needs are met. I know that there's a lot of pressure on them right now. And I see what's happening in the news right now, but I'm trying to make reference to 2017, 18, and 19. And I also want to bring awareness of, yeah, I think that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay. So the city budgets are, in my opinion, moral documents reflecting priorities and values. As part of Mayor Wheeler's police reform action plan, together with commissioners, the city redirected $12 million from the Police Bureau and city funds to communities of color. The plan supports non-law enforcement responses like Portland Street Response and the Navigation Team. At the same time, the Gun Violence Reduction Team and the School Resource Officer Program were dissolved. In a way, imagine you have a substantial bank account to invest as you see fit in public safety. Where would your priorities be and where would you fund that money? Reverend Haynes.
Yeah, I think when you say the word defunding, it means a lot of things to different people. I do believe that there are certain areas that the police department does not need to be engaged in, and particularly in terms of mental crisis. I think there needs to be a professional people without guns that are able to initiate the scene on 911 calls. There are many Marlos out there, even in our own state in Eugene, Oregon, where have performed tremendously on mental health crisis. I think on cases in terms of dealing with different areas of houselessness, intervention, those kind of things are areas that I think could be dealt better by professional people with training. And when you get into the issue of dealing with mental illness, the officers are not adequately prepared to deal with that. And some of the many shootings, whether we're talking about Aaron Campbell, whether we're talking about Keaton Otis, whether we're talking about other mental shootings that have created an uproar in the community, have been on the issues of mental illness. I think we need to take that out of the hand of the police bureau and give it to the hands of professional people.
Thank you very much. And I think we're definitely going in that direction. Portland Street Response, I think, had its budget moved from about $500,000 to $5 million. And it'll be really interesting to see how that rolls out in the near future. I do think that's a model that's been championed around the country to have non-gun-carrying individuals address some of the issues that we've been seeing from mental health as well as behavioral health crisis. So anybody else like to chime in on that?
Daryl Turner, can you hear me?
Yes.
So a lot of people who were around in the early 2000s, if you remember, the state of Oregon basically defunded the mental health system. When they defunded the mental health system, it left it upon the police to be able to take that over. That was not something that we did by ourselves or unilaterally, but the state of Oregon defunded, if you want to use the word defunded, the mental health system. So with that said, the police bureau had to adapt policies and training to be able to deal with those issues the best way we possibly could. So when we did that, everybody left it in our hands to deal with those in mental health crisis. And the result of what we have now is the defunded mental health system that we deal with in the state of Oregon. And even though we're starting to get hundreds of thousands and even hundreds of millions of dollars dedicated back to it, there's about 15 years of catch up to do. And I am one that wholeheartedly believes, yes, we should have appropriate responses to a mental health crisis that don't involve law enforcement. But if we do defund the police, we also lose that ability for us to respond to the ones that we need to respond to. We have a behavioral health unit that is one of the top units in the country and has got national recognition, even from the New York Times, as being a trendsetter in dealing with mental health crisis of law enforcement agencies. That, with that said, I'm not saying that we are the professionals that should be dealing with all of those, but we have made huge strides in that area over the past decade and a half to be able to deal with those situations, as a lot of the resources that are not funded anymore are not able to respond at 2:30 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, when there's nobody else out but the police to do that job.
That's interesting. Have you heard of what the discussions might be around if someone calls 911, how people would be routed to Portland Street Response versus maybe some of the providers in the area, maybe versus actual police in uniform? Daryl or anybody else?
Yeah, I wanted to say...
Reverend Haynes?
Yeah, I wanted to say in reference to the historicity of that is certainly very true. But what we have found out, and I've been dealing with each individual case since 2003, is that professional people are just automatically better people in dealing with mental crisis. And persons that are not in situations of carrying gun, even with the officers that are trained, in fact, some of them have advanced training, the immediate response in many instances on 9/11 calls is to run up on the scene and pull the gun first and then ask questions later. I think that kind of response is better handled by professional people. I've worked in mental institutions while I was in college, and we were able to appropriate training handle people with knives and other things better than the police department with guns.
And Reverend Haynes, I'll be the first one to say that I wholeheartedly believe that the first response should not be the police. That's not the business we want to be in. But you referenced a case like Keith Notice, for example. His mother tried everything she possibly could to get the mental health system to give him the assistance he needed, and they were not able to do it. That's not an indictment on anybody working in this system. It was the system itself that failed with Keith Notice. And so that was a situation where his mother many times tried to get help for him and could not. And because he was over the age of 18, there was nothing that she could force them to do. And so that's just one case of it. I get there's lots of cases where the police have responded and have not used weapons, have not used force, and have helped remedy some of those people in mental health crisis. But I do wholeheartedly agree that there needs to be a different response first before law enforcement is called in, only when there's weapons involved and there's someone who's not only endangering their own life, but the life of others.
Tiffany, I think you were next.
Hi, in regards to where should funding go, I have a couple suggestions. Body cams for all police officers. And number two, being in a Goose Hollow, we were a hot spot area for 2017-18, and the navigation team came in and worked extensively to really, really look at the situation and all of the needs in there, the criminality piece, the mental health issues, the homelessness, and also the livability piece of the neighborhood. I really like that model, the navigation team, where you've got the mental health therapists, you've got the everybody to reroute, like triage people in a certain area that where it's a hot spot to their respective areas. I feel like we need more of those navigation teams going into the future, and collaboratively, if we work together in teams handling things, people will get routed to the correct social services or mental health treatment. But we probably need to start looking into more detox programs for Portland, because I fear, especially in downtown, we are losing our detox programs, and there's no mental health court or diversion programs. And I absolutely love Portland Street Response, and with the navigation team down in Goose Hollow, that's where I learned of the Portland Street Response plan, and that was 2 years ago, and I've been begging for it ever since, because I really do like that idea. I do see people on the street suffering mental health crisis every single day, and that is not the you want someone to respond from that perspective. But when it comes to living in a hotspot area or working in a hotspot area, and if there is a true criminality piece, we do want the Portland Police to respond to us in a reasonable time and understand what services will be provided to us if truly it is a criminality situation. So I'm all aboard with, if the navigation team can have the Portland Street Response in there as well. I mean, I would love to see a team of people working in areas where there's situations. And I also feel with navigation teams, like down in Goose Hollow, they worked with the community. The dialogue was there. They worked with the community. And I think that every time you offer the opportunity to educate the community on these situations, it's a better outcome. So I think that that'd be great in the future if we could do that, but also do the body cams for the current situation.
Okay, thank you. Sabina, I think you have your hand up as well.
I love that everyone has been mentioning Street Response. You know, a lot of us in Lens have been excited about Street Response because that's where it was set to launch. My understanding from following the city council votes from last year is that with some of the cuts made to the police budget right now, there's going to be even more money for Street Response, which will make it more of a citywide program. Commissioner Hardesty and her staff have come to our meetings in February to talk about it, as along with Kaya, the executive director of Street Roots, who have been at the forefront of promoting it. And it just seems like a very promising idea. The way they want to involve the community, also, you know, in creating this change, I really appreciate it, and I'm excited about it. I like what you said, Vadim, about the budget being a moral document. We hear Commissioner Hardesty say that a lot. And as we talk about defunding, you know, the police, a more important aspect of that is actually investment, because that's how we define our priorities, by where we put our money, right? And if our priority is to serve the dignity of the individuals and communities while also decreasing recidivism and cost, then harm reduction, community investment, and increasing social services nets such as housing, public health, we're during a pandemic right now, education, you know, we're seeing cuts to education while the schools are closed due to a pandemic, and we don't know what the future will look like for our kids next year. Mental health, again, harm reduction services, but not just that at the individual level, but public health policies based on meeting individuals where they are and improving their quality of life. Support for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault support, gun violence, getting, you know, guns out of the hands of dangerous people who shouldn't have them, youth engagement programs. What are our youth doing these days? Because they are not in school, and they don't have a lot of places to go. Community centers are closed, you know. Parks have just barely reopened. And I also think that we should dream big when we try to reimagine community public safety and where we put money. What about transportation support? You know, what if when you get pulled over, instead of getting a ticket, you get someone who says, hey, I noticed your tailgate isn't working. Can I help you change it? Or you're registration has expired. Can I, do you have a, you know, can we do it right now? Do you have a credit card and we can renew your registration right now? And I also think, and with this, I will wrap up, that we don't talk enough about community conflict resolution and mediation. This has been my experience, you know, doing work in the community. I know that people are more likely to call the police on each other or to pull a gun on each other than to talk to their neighbor. And if you ask them, well, have you talked to them? They don't feel comfortable. They might not have the skills or the experience or the education. And the city used to invest. They used to have Resolution Northwest available as a free service to community members. I think if they went through their neighborhood association, but they have defunded that as well. And I think that that would be really helpful. And also investing in restorative justice, training folks in our community on what restorative justice looks like to help the communities that are struggling with conflict and keep folks out of jail and give them an opportunity to do better.
Thank you, Sabina. I want to touch on a couple of points you made, and I see Mark's hand up. But before Mark speaks, we have Chief Lavelle, who just joined the call. Chief, would you like to make a brief introductory remark, and then I'll kind of fill you in on our current discussion? And Chief Lavelle, can you hear me? You're on mute right now. Okay, great. And you're still on mute, Chief.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, perfect.
Sorry, I'm in the car. I just wrapped up a doctor's appointment. But thanks for having me and inviting me. I just really want to take the opportunity to hear what the last person said about restorative justice, kind of the mediation model. I'm a big believer in that. I think that's something that we don't take a lot of advantage of. I think it's a good way for people to just kind of get a better sense of each other and heal. So I'm just happy to have this opportunity to hear what people think and what people have to say. I'm really looking forward to ways we can incorporate, you know, some of that stuff into what we do at the police bureau.
All right, thank you, Chief. And we're discussing the apportioned budget, obviously, including Portland's food response, including programs for youth, and now including programs to maybe reduce violence that's been bent in the hands of the public, and things like that were mentioned. But let me touch with Mark real quick and see what comment he's had. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, hi. I'll be kind of brief because there's so much to talk about. Number one is body cams. Portland Police Bureau is the largest police agency in the state of Oregon, and we've been going back and forth about body cams. And I think it is such a disservice to our officers and to the community to not have what some of the smallest agencies out of the 14,000 agencies and police agencies have in this country. We need to catch up with the times with technology and what other agencies are doing. It's about accountability, and both sides need that. Second, Cahoots and Eugene. When I was working for the city of Portland, I was driving to work, I believe it was January of 2018, I apologize if my dates are off. I heard the OPB interview with the director of Cahoots. I'm driving, I'm getting this fuzzy feeling like, oh my goodness, this sounds like exactly what we need. Why are we not doing this? I literally parked my car, went into work when I was working with the city of Portland, and I reached out immediately to my contact at the mayor's office, and I said, I'm sure you know all about this, but I heard this amazing interview about Cahoots, and it seems like such a great model. And I mean this just objectively. The response was the mayor's office is going down there in a couple months. And I was very taken back that how, you could drive a couple hours to Eugene, check out a program that from everything I can tell and read and talk to people, it's a huge success. I believe it takes something like 20% of all calls to Eugene police are routed directly to Cahoots. I know I was a law enforcement officer not in Portland, in Washington County before, and I would have loved to have had a resource like that. And it's just so important. So I think we have the models like body cam. It's a good example. Portland needs to catch up. We need to see what other agencies are doing, what other cities are doing, and look at these government, private, community partnerships that work, that keep people safe, that keep police safe. And we really need to catch up to it. And lastly, I think it's all about the youth. The changes that we're aspiring to and hoping for, I think are going to be carried through my children and everyone's children and grandchildren on this call. We've got to be doing everything we can be doing with our youth And I think it's creating new programs. It's taking programs that maybe worked in the past, teaching our children how to interact with the police. What do you do if you think an officer did something wrong? What are your rights? What do you have to say? What do you not have to say? Why should you put your hands on the steering wheel if you're pulled over in the middle of the night? What's the officer going through? Why are they scared? Give our kids the skills and the education to know what's going on. And we've got to do so much. We used to do so many programs when I was with the city with the youth, and they all went away, and they got to come back. So thank you.
Thank you. So there were a couple of topics that certainly raised a lot of comments in the chat section, one of which is the body cameras. And there was a pilot project that was funded a while back where the police bureau was going to test out body cameras. I think since then that never occurred, and there's been certainly disagreement about whether body cameras actually effectuate any change. I believe Commissioner Hardesty noted that body cameras have not resulted in any change in behavior from the police bureau statistically. There are other articles I've read that show that there is, that people treat each other nicer on the streets, if that's something that makes sense, at least if they have body cameras on, more congenial behavior between individuals. And I believe that there was a body camera recording in the George Floyd incident that sort of outlined some of the things that happened there. Pros and cons on body camera. I know we've heard a little bit about that, but I'd love to hear specifically from Daryl and Charles, and Chuck, I'm sorry, as well as anybody else about body cameras who hasn't spoken already about that.
Sorry, Chief.
No, go ahead, Daryl.
I have been a strong advocate of body cams from the very beginning. I think they are an accountability measure that we need. I think as long as the checks and balances are there to protect community members' privacy and, you know, health information and things such as that, that it would be a great tool for accountability. All over the country, a lot of the images that we see come from video of from people's phones, even, let alone police body cams and dash cams. So I do think, and I'm wholeheartedly 100% on board with outfitting every important police officer with a body cam to be able to record events, as well as it helps us in training of what does work and what doesn't always work. But I just want to make sure that the policy fits the application of body cams to the officers that work out on the street every day.
And I would add too, I'm a supporter of body cameras. I think they're a great tool for accountability. I also think it's a good way to really capture what happens on the street and what officers deal with on a regular basis. And I also feel like there's kind of a safety piece for the community, where I think a lot of people feel like if an officer has a body cam that they'll behave in a way that's really comports to whatever the directives are. So I think there's a little bit of that feeling on the street. One of the other issues though is body cams are very expensive, not so much at the outset, but in the storage and management and auditing of the data. So there's some serious costs on the back end of having a body camera program, especially for a city the size of Portland.
So since I know body cams was recently taken off the table in the budget, right? So I guess, you know, even though I'm hearing you both say that you support it because it doesn't look like that's going to be funded, what do you think are alternatives? I mean, I hear you say that they're good for accountability. So what are other tools of accountability that you think we need to be implementing? And that was to you, yeah, PPA and PPB.
Okay, I think some of the other things that we can be implementing as accountability tools. So in the last legislative session there were several bills, there were six bills that went to the legislature. There were police accountability bills. The PPA supported five of the six bills. I think the mandatory reporting bill was very important for police accountability. That would be if one police officer saw another police officer doing something inappropriate, up to including excessive force. Number one, they would stop whatever that is that the officer was doing, and then also immediately report that to a supervisor. I think that's one accountability tool. And even though we have a policy that already covers that, the state law makes it more extensive. And so I think that's one. I think another one is the information sharing bill. I can't remember the name of it. I believe it's 4207, where if a police officer has several sustained complaints, especially when it comes to use of force, disparate treatment and misconduct, there's a database that has been created or will be created that will document that, so that if a police officer goes to another agency, that information goes to that agency. They're able to access that through the background investigation. I think those are two important bills for accountability, as well as body cams. Hopefully in the future, we will see those in the city of Portland, because other agencies, smaller, have found ways to finance and afford body cams, and have done that in a way where it doesn't break their budget.
All right, thank you, everybody. Speaking of accountability, that dovetails with the next question, or the next topic of conversation. Portland currently has an oversight agency to impartially review complaints against the Portland Police Bureau and its officers. The agency is called the Independent Police Review, and it's part of the Auditor's Office, so it's removed from the Portland Police Bureau. And then we also have a Citizen Review Committee who is sponsoring this dialogue tonight, which is made up of community members appointed by City Council as a whole to hear complaints. Ross Caldwell is the director of IPR, and he's agreed to provide a brief overview on what IPR does, and then we'll talk about accountability once that overview is provided. Ross?
Hey, thank you very much. Again, my name is Ross Caldwell. I'm the director of IPR. I've been at IPR a little under a year, and just kind of a quick overview of what we do, because I know nobody's here to hear me talk. We take complaints from the community about their interactions with Portland Police Bureau. We also take commendations about Portland Police Bureau. So if somebody wants to report something that was a favorable interaction, they can do that as well. But I don't think that's really the focus of our discussion tonight. So we are a staff of 15 people, and we are housed under the City Auditor's Office. And if anyone is unaware of this, in Portland's kind of unique form of government structure, we have the four members of the City Council, and then the fifth being the mayor. And then we have the City Auditor, who's the sixth elected official. And all the government transparency and accountability kind of stuff usually lives under the City Auditor. So that's where we're housed. Like I said, there's 15 people that work for IPR. Currently, about half of us are investigators, and we take complaints from the community. We take about 400 complaints a year from community members, and we also take complaints from Portland Police Bureau officers about Portland Police Bureau officers, which is something that is kind of surprising to people at times. But we get about, on average years, we get about 50 of those a year. In the last couple of years, those have kind of ticked up into the low 70s and a little higher this last year. So that's something we're keeping an eye on. We also monitor internal affairs investigations, and those include investigations of use of deadly force by police officers. So when I say that we monitor investigations, we don't perform those investigations ourselves. We monitor the investigation. So we review transcripts, we review interviews, we can sit in on interviews at times, and we make sure that the questions are being asked that we think need to be asked, and that the investigation is adequate before it can go to someone else who reviews that investigation and makes a recommendation or a decision. We also conduct policy reviews. And so we can look at Portland Police Bureau policies, and it's kind of like a little miniature audit in a way. If you're not familiar with them, we have a lot of those on our website. And I'd ask David, if you get a chance, I know there's a lot of stuff in the chat right now, but if you could put that in the chat so people could have a link to our website and maybe to our annual report as well. So we do policy reviews and we also do some data analysis. So we have data dashboards on our website, and that's something that we're trying to increase in the next few years. We also provide support for the Citizen Review Committee, which, as Vadim said, is hosting this meeting tonight. And just the last thing I would mention, I know this is kind of a lot of information in a quick rush, but the last thing I would mention is that we are, and have been, I think, since Dana, the deputy director, and I started, we've been trying to work with the folks at the CRC and with our boss, Mary, the auditor, to try to figure out ways we can improve our system and make it more transparent so that people in the community can see our investigations. We are currently limited by the fact that we can't release our investigations, and that is because of a couple of state statutes and some provisions in the union contract. So those are things that we would really like to do going forward. We are funded by taxpayer money, and we think that it's much more appropriate that people can see, other than, you know, sometimes where I think for individual safety, we would need to hold things out of our investigation or redact certain parts. We want to be able to release our investigation so that they're more publicly available and that the entire system becomes more transparent. So I'll be around for any questions, but that's kind of our quick overview.
All right. Thanks, Ross. A quick question from a couple comments. How many misconduct cases are open right now?
We've hit about 50 individual investigations that are based on the protests. And that's quite a few for us to have open at any given time. So our investigations go through kind of several phases. And we're currently at around 50 that are based on protests since those started, 44 days ago, whatever we're at now. So we have quite a few of those going on. That might sound like a low number to some people. And I should, maybe to give some context, I should say that we have received a ton of contacts from community members, but what we can actually investigate are individual incidents that involve a community member and a Portland police officer. So if we get a call from somebody or an email from somebody, of which we've had several thousand, that says defund the police or, you know, stop using tear gas or something like that, if it's not somebody who's having an individual kind of interaction with a police bureau member, that's not something we can investigate. That's something that we can forward on to city council or to the mayor's office or to people that make those kind of bigger policy decisions, or we could make Chief Lavelle aware of that or something like that. But we investigate cases where it is an individual interaction with a Portland Police Bureau member and a community member.
And then with the budget for IPR, where does it fall? Is it part of the Portland Police Bureau budget or the auditor's budget?
No, we're completely separate from the Portland Police Bureau. So we're under the auditor. So it's part of the auditor's budget.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So there's a system in place wherein complaints are being investigated. However, as many of you are aware, there's been a push recently to have a whole new entity created to hear complaints against the police bureau. This entity would have funding equal to 5% of the Portland police budget, or it will be taken from the Portland police budget of 5%, which is about $12 million. As I understand it, the current budget for IPR is about $2 million, and correct me, Ross, if I'm wrong. Would anybody have input on what they would like to see from the oversight agency? I know there's been some comments, which I'll address in a minute from the chat room, but what do y'all see as necessary for true police accountability?
You're muted, Dr. Haynes.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Since 2003 with the Kendra James case, the Obama Minister Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform has called for an independent citizen review board that would in turn have the power to subpoena and to compel testimony for officers. Now, I've been one of the founding members of that created IPR, one of the founding members that created CRSC, and all of them have major limitations upon them, like investigation of their divorce case. But there's a great need if we're going to rebuild trust in our community. The public feel that there's a double standard that takes place in police shootings and in terms of excessive force case. One of the reasons why we brought the Department of Justice in was of the issue of excessive force and deadly force cases that have taken place, like Aaron Campbell and James Chassie, who was beaten to death by officers. Those kind of cases require an independent a citizen review body that would be able to do an overview and make recommendations. And I think we're going to always be limited without having something like that. And the trust in the community is going to always be scarce without having that kind of independent citizen review board. I don't know where the co-chairman got those numbers for, but those numbers have never been given out by the anyone that has been a part of creating an independent review board. Thank you.
I think those numbers are correct, but if I'm wrong, Ross, if you could chime in about that. I think 5% of the police bureau budget is about $12 million. Does that sound about right?
I think as the budget currently stands, it would be somewhere around $11 or $12 million if the budget stayed what it is right now. And obviously it would take some time to put a new commission together. So my understanding would be that that's how much it would be if it is held at 5%. And if there's just one other thing I could point out, I really appreciate what Dr. Haynes said. And I think it's good for context to know that we're not the decision makers on discipline cases at IPR. We're basically kind of the intake part. And so we take in the complaints and we do the investigations. And, you know, I think whoever ultimately makes discipline decisions for officer violations of directives, that's a city council decision. That's a big policy decision. And there's a lot of, you can have a great discussion around that. And that's something that is a decision that should be made far above my head. But whoever does it, you're going to need somebody to do the investigations. And they need to be done in a way that kind of keeps an eye on all of the intricate rules of labor law and employee rights. Otherwise, it will get overturned by an arbitrator. And so I think there's a lot of, sometimes I hear people talk about the IPR system, and it's really the police oversight system. We take things in, but we don't ultimately get to make the decision. We make recommendations, but the mayor, as the police commissioner, is the one who ultimately makes discipline decisions in the current system.
Thank you. But anybody have any other ideas? With $12 million, that to me seems like a lot of money in which to be able to hire investigators, to be able to, you know, have greater outreach, to be able to get community involvement, to be able to broadcast what's happening. To let you all know, the CRC meetings are open. You know, they're lightly attended. We only have maybe a dozen people that come to our meetings. So everybody, once we have either virtual meetings or in-person meetings, please attend so you can see how the system functions currently. But any other thoughts on how we can improve police oversight? Let's see, there's a hand raised. Sabina?
Thank you. Yeah, I think the committee should be engaged in the new contract negotiations for the Portland Police Association that are starting in January 2021. I think just our community in general should have more involvement in determining if the contract is helping or hurting the people of Portland and our city as a whole. You know, I have some concerns about how, like, the labor union contract is used by officers. I wrote here Article 58 of the current Portland Police Association contract states that officers shall have an opportunity to purchase additional weapons from the city at the city's cost. So I'm wondering, you know, is our city really safer when we have a police union contract that encourages officers to amass firearms at cost for personal use? There are many things like that in the contract that I think would benefit us if we had more transparency on, and if we were involved in those negotiations, and they weren't done behind closed doors.
There's a question I just got put up. I'll address real quick. Who writes the policies? The policies are initially written by the Portland Police Bureau, and then they publicize it, and people have, I believe, a two-week period to respond to those policies and make any kind of changes. Then there's a second round of that, and then people have another, I believe, 2 weeks. I could be off on the timing a little bit, but I think that's right. And there's also some organizations such as the CRC, the Citizen Review Committee, as well as the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing, that is endowed with certain responsibilities to provide feedback on policy and make recommendations to policies as well. And any community member can apply to be on those committees, which I think is very educational for those that want to participate in some of these changes that we're discussing here.
Can I just say something real quick, Vadim, because people are asking in the chat about, how do we have access to the policy process and whether we're volunteers or not? So just wanted to clarify, yes, the CRC, we're all volunteers. And I'm gonna be honest, there's definitely a capacity issue. I think that's something that, you know, Vadim and I have been talking a lot about with different stakeholders on, you know, these issues are very serious. And obviously, yes, we have the independent police review. Those are full-time staff members in the city of Portland. But we often defer some of these really important decisions to these volunteer boards. So I think we also need to reassess how do we put these boards together? How are we giving them the ability to participate in this process? And when it comes to things like policy, like we'll get an email that's like, this directive is open for 2 weeks. And it's like, okay, well, thanks for telling me on the first day of those 2 weeks. And I have my 40-hour week job and I have a million other things. And it's really, really hard to participate in those policy processes that are currently built in to change directives. So I think that's a huge issue I'd like to see us address, and how we're maybe making that window longer so that we can actually have the ability to comment, because those windows come and go super quick, and then it leaves us on the CRC sometimes just unable to respond in a timely fashion. And I think that it backs up, right? All of these policy decisions that we could be hopefully making in these times, they just kind of back up and we're at where we are now. So I think that whatever the new process looks like, whatever the new oversight system looks like, we really need to take into consideration the human capacity of the people doing this work and making sure that it's fully funded and staffed. We need people that have data analysis, expertise. I know IPR has mentioned on multiple occasions that they have trouble getting data from PPD. And then you need data to make change, right? And so if they have those barriers, and then we have our barriers as volunteers, and then we need more, staff personnel time to dedicate to that, I think that's where we need to, at least in my opinion, put some money towards that, because that's, otherwise we're just kind of flailing, it feels like, a lot of the time, trying to address everything as quickly as we can, but there's a huge capacity problem.
Exactly. Both the CRC and the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing have work groups on policy, and anybody can be a member of those work groups. You don't have to be an actual member on the committee to participate. So if you want to actually review policies, help draft policies, and help improve policies, certainly, we're looking for all the help we can get on those committees. Moving on to the next topic of conversation, speaking of policies, the Portland Police Bureau has adopted a use of force policy that mandates that police de-escalate a conflict, disengage when benefits outweigh the risks to public safety, use force only as a last resort, intercede to prevent the use of unlawful force by another officer, and report violations of the law and policy by other officers. This is all within their use of force policy. And PPB bans chokeholds unless it's an incident where there's an immediate threat to life. However, Eric Garner was killed on Staten Island in 2014 by a police officer who used a chokehold that was banned by the New York Police Department more than two decades before that. And Minneapolis had a policy in place that required police officers to intervene if they saw an officer using excessive force, but three officers did not intervene when that happened. What else would it take to prevent more of these deaths? How can we encourage officers to stand up? How can we encourage people to de-escalate force when necessary? And how can we, once again, keep people accountable so these incidents stop occurring?
And can I just say, like, I definitely would love to hear, you know, what PPA President Turner and PPB Chief Lavelle have to say about this. Obviously, this is super timely, this conversation. There's a lot going on. People are very frustrated. And I know I really want to hear what you all have to say about the situations that have unraveled in the streets recently. So I'd encourage you to answer these questions.
This is Chief Lavelle. We've been looking at our use of force policies here recently, and you know, currently a chokehold for us is not an approved control hold. We do have it in our policy as a deadly force option, but it's literally a last resort. We haven't used that since the mid 80s, essentially, with Lloyd Stevenson. So, you know, for us, as far as a control hold, we don't use it. There's some wording issues. We're trying to get in line with the Eight Can't Wait campaign, but this was recently looked at by the state legislature also. So we have to make sure we're in line with the state legislature, and then also make sure our policies are, you know, not only in accordance with the state, but also with, you know, whatever Eight Can't Wait accepts as wording. But for us, essentially, that's a banned use of force, except for in the instance where it's a last resort deadly force option.
And I'll agree with Chief Lavelle. I've been, like I said, I've been a police officer here 29 years, and I came on in 1991, and the chokehold was banned except for use of deadly force at that point in time. So it has been banned for at least 30 years, if not longer. And as for officers who report other officers' use of excessive force, or whether it be any kind of misconduct, we have that here. As police union president for the last 10 years almost, actually it is 10 years, I have probably had over a dozen officers come into our office and ask for our help in defense of violation policies that no longer allow them to be police officers at the city of Portland. And we have denied them that that option to have the unions support them. We just don't publicize it. I think it's something that a lot of people don't know. Somebody has just lost their job and their families are affected. So it's not something we publicize, but it is out there that we have denied access to union representation to members who have violated policy that have caused them to lose their job. And we will continue that that policy, that procedure, as long as a member does something like that. The cases that we fought in arbitration have a few and far between, we too don't want bad police officers in our agency or any agency as well. So we have done that, and we will continue to do that.
Sorry, did I understand you correctly? Are you saying that the PPA can deny membership to officers who continuously violate use of force? Is that, I mean, I'm oversimplifying it, but is that what you're saying?
No, what I'm saying is if a member comes to us that has violated policy and asks the union to file a grievance on their behalf, we have told members before, even up to termination, not just the other discipline, but up to termination, we have told them, no, we're not going to represent you with a grievance. They're still PPA members, and that's why they come to us. But at that point in time, they're either going to be terminated or they're going to resign as a police officer from the Portland Police Bureau. We have denied them. We have denied their ability to either file a grievance or to move forward with a grievance because they have violated policies that no longer allow them to be a police officer. That's happened over a dozen times. It's not just a one-off here or there. It's happened more than a dozen times with us over my tenure in the last 10 years.
Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah, may I say something here? Okay. Yeah, one of the things I've said, I want to put it in context that we've been in federal court over the last three or more years on the question of excessive force and deadly force and the use of force by the police department here. In 2011, the Department of Justice came down here and did a thorough investigation. And out of that investigation came a finding that the Portland Police Bureau used excessive and deadly force against the mentally ill persons and persons perceived to be mentally ill. Out of that, we went into negotiation with a settlement agreement that dealt with all areas within the Portland Police Bureau. And that was one of the reasons why we've had increased substance in the policies and in the training. It was not something that was done naturally. It was something that was forced by the outcry of the community and the outcry in the federal court and the leveraging of the legal system that forced the Bureau hand to make those necessary changes. And still, even with the great gap that exists in putting those policies in practice, we've had an de-escalation cases like a young teenager at Roosevelt by the name of Di Gruddy, where the officer that used excessive force with him and was in the juvenile court where that person had advanced training and still used excessive force against this young black teenager, Di Gruddy. And the judge in the case in juvenile caught the officers in lying in several different instances about the use of that force, you know. So there's a gap that exists even with the policies and the practices and the training that is not accountable unless that sergeant on that level and other within the command staff begin to exercise and hold officers accountable for excessive force and deadly force. We still are not going to make those, you can have the best training in the world, the best policy in the world, but if there's no accountability, then we're still at the starting line.
Thank you, Reverend Haynes. And I want to say Reverend Haynes has put a lot of work into this over years now, working with both the Justice Department, the Portland Police Bureau, and constituents to implement some of the settlement agreement that the Portland has with the Justice Department to improve the Police Bureau. The federal judge has found that the Portland Police Bureau is in compliance with the vast majority of the settlement agreement, but that's only kind of the base. You know, more can be done in the future to be better at policing. But Reverend Haynes has been involved in this for a very long time. So thank you for your input on that, sir.
Thank you.
And also I want to recognize that we have Pastor Hennessy on the discussion now. Pastor Hennessy, can you just quickly introduce yourself and I'll bring you up to speed a little bit.
Yes, good evening, everyone. My name is Pastor J.W. Matt Hennessy of the Vancouver Avenue First Baptist Church here in Portland. And I lead the Interfaith Peace and Action Collaborative and co-leader of the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and spent at least 15 years of my life leading in public administration, also city administration and police and fire administration as well. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and I'm humbled and honored as I see the group of people that are here assembled.
Thank you, sir. Our current discussion here is about use of force. I sort of summarize some of the use of force policies that the Police Bureau has, and it seems to address a lot of the issues that are being discussed nationally as to what police bureaus can do to keep incidents such as Eric Garner or George Floyd from occurring. But time and time again, individual officers may not be adhering to those policies, and those policies fail. And so, you know, how do we make sure that people intervene if they see something wrong? How do we ensure that people follow policies when it comes to chokeholds and using less restrictive force or even backing away when possible? Since you just joined us, would you have any thoughts on that, Pastor Hennessy?
That is so unfair. If possible, I'd rather listen a little bit more, may I?
Of course. We have Sabina's hand raised.
Yeah, I'm so sorry because I just came out of an emergency meeting with a business, and that's why I'm late. I apologize for that.
That's okay. The next topic conversation is going to, I think, have plenty of input as well, so we might go to that. But in the meantime, Sabina, would you like to comment?
Yeah. Well, you know, I hear Daryl Turner and others who have said that there are clear policies against excessive use of force. But just based on what else we see around us and at protests right now, if there's been an effort by the city to improve police training around use of force, it's clearly not being put into practice. And we can see that by how they're responding to protesters. You know, again, we're entering day 47 of our local police deploying military-grade munitions on peaceful protesters. Again, Donovan Lobella fighting for their life in their hospital after they were shot in the head by impact munition while they were holding a boombox. So I would love to see that addressed in terms of, is that not excessive? You know, I have been at protests, and I will say that I don't know what the officers' intentions are, but it is very disorienting. When they say, tell the crowd certain commands, and then people follow the commands, like they'll say, don't go on the bridges to exit town, head west out of town. So now you have the crowd exiting and walking away from the police. And then they corner, you know, the police comes and like corners protesters in various places. And we've seen these accounts from journalists, from community leaders, you know, Commissioner Hardesty has acknowledged all of their stories, and they corner them and shoot at them or gas them or.
We all know the incidents. I guess
is that not excessive, you know, given current circumstances and given what's happening in the street?
Okay, but what would you recommend that we do to address these things? Certainly we can have the police discuss their reasons for it, but as far as accountability goes, what would you think the solution would be? You know, what's the next step? How do you if there is excessive force, if there's allegations of excessive force, what do you see as the need in order to ensure that that doesn't happen? What framework are we talking about?
Well, I mean, I think having a committee such as this one involved in overseeing some of these practices and making recommendations would be good. At the same time, I know that in the past, when the city was involved in a settlement for excessive use of force, we did have a committee like that that did review police practices and did make recommendations over a period of a couple of years. I forget their exact name. Committee, Portland Community Engaged Policing. Yeah, but yet still here we are, you know, in 2020. So I certainly understand people who are saying that this is not going to work. We just need to scrap it, like other cities have done. Across the country, not too many, but a couple have done where they've just removed their police department entirely. I'm not saying I'm advocating for that, but that's certainly something that's happened.
There's a couple hands, Vadim. We want to get Mark and Alex.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, hi. I was watching the news, and I believe it was the Houston, Texas police chief being interviewed. And this was probably maybe the second week into the protesting. And what I like to share with this group is, you know, what's a tangible thing we can actually do? He gave his community and through the nation step-by-step processes to what you should do as an individual community member when you believe you are seeing police misconduct ranging from an officer being disrespectful and rude, cursing, all the way up to something as horrible as what we saw in Minneapolis. It was very specific. Film it from different angles. See if there's someone else across the street who is also filming it. Immediately call 911 if it's a violent affair, and if you think you should. Call 911 and explain exactly what's going on. I'm at 4th and Main. I'm watching a police officer from this department doing this. I believe it is excessive force. I need a supervisor to respond to this situation immediately. You film all of that. And again, a tangible thing is, how do we do that? How do we give some confidence back to the community that they can safely observe and document this and do their part safely in a very unsafe and scary situation for many people? And I like that, because I don't think I've ever heard a chief of police giving the community and the, you know, the nation via CNN exact things to do and articulate what to do. I mean, calling 911 and asking for a supervisor to respond to the scene immediately, I think is great. So I think it's giving the community more, you know, the protests, I think it's hard because we have so much going on with the protests, and there's so many complex use of force incidents there. You have federal agents involved, and they're not Portland cops in a lot of the situations. I think we need to look at also, just, it's a Sunday afternoon, you are walking your dog down your street and you think you're seeing misconduct by your police, what do you do?
Yeah, that's a good point. And the meetings I've been attending, I've been trying to tell people whom to go to file these complaints, because there are certainly a lot of complaints, and everybody wants to know what's the next step. So I think it's incumbent upon us and certainly other members of both committees, volunteer committees, as well as people who are hearing this, to be able to tell people where to go. Candace, who else was waiting to be
Alex.
Oh, Alex. Thank you.
Hey guys, so just from my experience kind of living on the streets in Old Town during COVID-19, there's been a lot of changing in people's lives, especially with the people who have to live on the streets. For example, right now with the protests, tying up a lot of the hands of the police, there's a lot of calls that don't get really answered in Old Town. So from person to person down there, what you see now is right now it's just a lot more weapons from just to help defend themselves. But me being involved in there is, and living on the streets too as well, I'm involved kind of most days now, a week at least, de-escalating some fights. I can tell you, I don't carry weapons on me. I don't do anything like that. I literally just kind of stand my ground a lot of the times and just let my calmness kind of beat out whatever anger is coming out of me, because there's just so many mental health issues. I think a lot of times the best ways to handle this, I think we are in a good conversation when it comes to focusing resources in other areas like Portland Street Response and helping to, even though it's not an immediate answer, but a long-term answer, solving a lot of these issues upstream before they become issues where police brutality has to even take a place in the situation. I think the more we focus on just kind of outreach and meeting people where they're at, and helping take those situations out of the streets before it becomes an issue like this, I think is the best thing that we can focus on.
Thank you, Alex, and I appreciate what you're seeing over there. So to kind of go along with what you just said, I was reading researching some stuff online, and the International Association of Chiefs of Police put out a statement that said defunding the police was misguided. I know there's going to be disagreement about that, but that's what they said. And that funding cuts in social and medical welfare often put officers in untenable positions because they're often the only ones left to call to situations where a social worker or mental health professional would be more appropriate and safer for all involved. So it seems that there is perhaps some agreement with police chiefs and some of the protesters that police are maybe not the best responders to some incidents that are out there. Of course, if there's violence, if there's weapons, you know, who else are you gonna call? There's 400 million guns in the United States, more than there are people in civilian hands at least. And so what do you do? And I guess my next topic of conversation is, police mostly spend their times on motor vehicle issues, traffic issues, burglar alarms, noise complaints, and you know, even problems with animals. And when police reports lead to criminal charges, only a subset of those, nationally about 80%, are from misdemeanors. Some people argue that police should be more hands-off and that there are other things that other people, social workers, or other individuals that are better trained to handle situations like that. What if Americans retrained ourselves to expect armed officers only if they truly think there's a risk of real harm to getting hurt, and dispatchers would be routed to call other people for crimes or a risk to harm to such as social workers, mediators, or other individuals? Is that a viable alternative? I mean, is there a way to de-escalate situations not involving serious crimes or crimes involving weapons and let other individuals handle those situations? What do y'all think about that?
You've got two hands, so we got Tiffany and then Liz.
Tiffany?
Hi, yes. Thank you, Vadim, for framing that question. My thoughts are, I'm just going to go back to the fact that my son and I were crime victims by a serial offender in Portland that went unchecked and is still unchecked, and who's pled to guilty to two felonies to harming a mom and child in their home. So I just want to clarify, when I do see the future, when we do defund, I think what we need to do is, there's certain data, and I think Candace touched upon that, there's certain data that cannot be shared, but if there's less police out there and there's going to be more weapons on the street, and there's some more, we got to think about victims out there in terms of, for example, the recog process. If you do have only a certain amount of police officers out there and you have a broken recog process, that means you take the people off the street, you hold them for about 4 hours. You may or may not know if they're a serial offender, the true people that are offending our society, the true criminals, and then you release them, and then based on a random recog process, I think that's broken. So I really worry that I would like us to have other pieces fixed before we decrease police officers, like the recog process. I'm just saying out loud, we will defund certain parts and there will be a decrease in police, but I would like it to be more efficient. When I realize that there are, say, 100 serial offenders, and not everybody may be I'm talking about the 10%, the top serial offenders that commit really, really bad offenses in the community. I think we should use the data that the police can focus on those people instead of doing stop and searches or random profiling. I'm just saying, is there any we could, with the funding, the funding that we could use on data that's more specific to what's really offending our community, instead of going around blindly? So I'm rambling, but I just see broken systems. And I just want to make a comment about the restorative justice. I'm a crime victim, and I don't even think I will ever be able to utilize the restorative justice, because our system is so broken. That serial offender is still out there, and he just cuts the GPS bracelet off and keeps running around. So that, to me, it doesn't mean anything, because many of us victims don't even get that part. And many of the victims out there right now that are victims of crime, that we see every day, probably aren't going to get any kind of justice as well. So there's a big group of us out there. It's not just the protesters that are being victimized. Actually, a lot of victims out there. So we got to look at how we get data to be specific on who we target in an unbiased way.
Thank you, Tiffany, for having the courage to share your personal experience.
Can I just say something too? I met with Commissioner Hardesty about this, and she commended me on focusing on criminal behaviors in the community. And I think we all should focus on criminal acts of violence and behaviors, and less on the profiling of people, but the behaviors and then the data that supports that. And I think, Candace, I keep going back to that. We got to access that data and share it with other agencies so we can learn from this and utilize that data to prevent this kind of stuff.
Thank you, Tiffany. And Alex, did you have your hand up?
It was Liz next.
Oh, Liz, thank you.
Yeah, I think that before even touching on the subject of the concept of 911, the concern for so many folks in the trans and queer community is simply that they don't feel comfortable calling the police in the first place. Typically, it's because they feel as though they will not be heard, they won't be taken seriously based on whatever has happened to them. Sometimes they also are victims of police harassment too, particularly in Black and Brown trans communities. And so, you know, taking the 911 aspect even off the table, then there's the issue of what can we reimagine? And I think that one thing that I've really enjoyed about listening to folks in the community is that there's a lot of creativity and possible solutions. So, you know, one of the discussions that I've heard throughout this evening is that mental health services, social services, education have all been defunded. And so the police are concerned because they're having to fill that role. Well, surprise, we've got a great solution. Put the funding back into those social services, those community organizations that are serving Black and Brown folks, that are serving queer and trans folks, that are serving our communities. And I think that that's one of the main things. So that if someone calls 911 or whatever new number that we can imagine in our creative solution, you know, people will respond. They'll see folks from their community respond in a compassionate, affirming way. Not people with guns, but folks in their neighborhood who care about their well-being. And I think that together we can make that happen without the police.
Thank you, Liz. Anybody else? Mark?
I think it's a great question. My hope is for the future, and I'm just going to focus on Portland. I think it's, we have so many things going on nationally. I really just want to focus on what can we do as a community with PPB, with our police. And I've heard the police from individual officers, and also, I don't want to speak, you know, Daryl, chime in here if I'm getting this wrong, but I believe the police have been asking for clarity. And I've heard a lot of police chiefs mirror that theme of you've asked us to follow, you know, to respond to all these other failures in our community, and we would prefer to do law enforcement. And I think that's my position personally. Just police is law enforcement, and it's up to the community to decide. I think generally, what laws do we want enforced, and how do we want them enforced? Do we want to expect our police to respond to just violent crimes in progress and active shooter, and we don't want a police response for low level, issues? And so I think it's give our police the clarity on the types of law enforcement they should be doing. And that with that comes expectations to the community of what are the police going to be doing. Just a couple things. I worked for the city's crime prevention program for years. And what I loved about it was we were part of a different bureau. I drove a Honda and I wore I kind of wore a shirt like this. And it was wonderful because I would show up to communities, say in Cully, in areas that where people were afraid of the police. And even though I was with the city, it was unique in Portland that crime prevention was not part of the police bureau. And we were able to reach out to a lot of members of the community that in most traditional cities, crime prevention is part of a police department. So it would be a police officer or someone in a police logo. The city of Portland has been doing things differently unique when it comes to police and services. And I think we need to, part of this reform is what worked and why are those gone? Because again, you know, I left the city, 7 people left the crime prevention program. We're not doing that work. We're not going out in those communities. Lastly, too, how do we avoid bringing an armed law enforcement officer into a situation that aggravates it or escalates that situation? A lot of the police reform I would like to see is the government leading the way. It's leadership and saying that we have a duty to inform and educate our community on how their public safety system works. Simple things like online reporting. Most people don't know about online reporting. And we don't need a police officer to show up in your neighborhood to take a report because someone stole your shovel last week. You do it online. The PS3 program, the Public Safety Support Specialists, I follow that very closely. I was an officer out in Washington County. I left policing, sworn to law enforcement in 2008. My last agency, we had 8 or 9 community service officers with the police department, but they did not carry guns. And they took a large percentage of our, I would call, customer service calls. They took evidence, non-injury accidents, The community service officer model has been in place in many, many cities, and I think we need to look at it. Look at what we're doing with the PS3s. I know that their uniforms are different. I know that we're already putting a different spin on it. But we bring the community in because we need to provide people with service. We need to provide victims of crime with good service to file a report, to get an insurance claim. If it's a felony crime or a violent crime, we need that infrastructure. But we need to make it much easier, and we need to explain to the community how those things are happening. And so to simple up, our public safety system needs to be user-friendly, and we need to educate and encourage our community to be a part of it, because it really is. And I think we lose sight of that. It's us versus them and the community and the police. This is one whole part to it, and we've got to put these things into unison.
Thank you, Mark. Pastor Hennessy, would you like to have the floor at all on these conversations? And you're on mute, sir, if you wanted to have, but I wanted to give you some time in case you wanted to respond.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, what we're talking about tonight and what has been going on are very difficult subjects. And unfortunately, I don't think that we've had the kind of forum, and perhaps this is what the approach is tonight, to really help people talk, from a standpoint of being able to hear each other, and to recognize that our experiences are, maybe very different, but ultimately the larger goal is how we can have, policing and community. And I look at policing from a standpoint of peacekeeping. I don't look at it from a standpoint of law enforcement, if you will, although I know that's part of what policing is all about. But part of my belief is that it is really important that there are channels of communication between police and community that allow the community to be able to both hear what the police have to say and understand where they're coming from, as well, and very important, that the police is able to hear its community and understand where its community is coming from as well. And I do believe that over the last, I can't tell you how many years, that if you look at activity of the police, it has been, and I believe that they would rather not be the ones who are, being the first responders, if you will, to many of the mental health crises that go on in our city. But unfortunately, they're the ones that get called for it. I also believe that it is very important that we learn how to use more civilians, which has been touched on today. One of the beliefs I have, even when it comes to school resource, I wasn't a fan of taking school resource out of the schools, specifically because I believe the local narrative is different than the national narrative, because I've stood next to the young people in marches downtown and in rallies in the parks, and they may say all kind of horrible things about the police, but when their school resource officer shows up, they are like high-fiving them, because that is the person that they have an awful lot of respect for and appreciation for, because they have developed relationships. The next thing I would say is that there are retired people out there in a number of different positions that they've retired from, that I believe that could help in this responsibility, and that our police, honestly, I saw somewhere in the chat where somebody was talking about implicit bias training and, stuff like that. And I have to just tell you, I'm not a fan of checking a box, I went to a seminar. Forgive me for that, but I'm just telling you, I think it takes more disruption than that, because I believe that what needs to happen is that whatever training occurs with police ought to be training that not just shows them about how they are interacting and creating relationship between themselves and the community, but it's how that changes them for their life. A lot of people have lived a life, whether it's a privilege or a fear or of whatever it might be, but there is unlearning that has to go on, and there's new learning that has to replace it. So those are some comments that I want to make. My goal is to really work to say, where can we find that space where we are able to, with calm heads, say, let's sit down and create reforms that talk about how we want to have our city be peaceful and safe, and how we can have relationship that goes back and forth between police officers and community that help us work together and be on the same page. Some of the things that are going on right now, I'm terribly sorry to say I don't have a good answer for, and I've seen a lot of information in the chat, and I feel bad about it because I've lived here 30 years of my life in this community, and I don't think I've ever seen us as at polar opposites as we are right now. And my I hope everybody hears me. I'm sincere when I say this. I really want us to figure out how to get along and work together. I really do. And, you know, I've been a monitor, a settlement agreement monitor when it comes to racial issues. I've dealt with what it's like to deal with some very difficult racial standards in police and fire and stuff like that. But I know we can do better than this. Portland, to me, is always the city that we can figure out whatever issue we have. We've always been good at it. It takes a while, but we can get there. And I pledge my effort to do everything that I can to do that as well. And again, I know that people like Dr. Haynes and others have been working at this for a long time. And I know that our new police chief really wants to succeed. Our leader of the police union wants to, and as I see the 150 some people that have been on this call, I've got to believe we're all here because we really believe in the bigger picture of Portland and the opportunity for us to continue to be what we have been, and that is the model to other communities as to what can happen. So I say to you from the faith community that I'm here willing to do everything I can, but I want to be thoughtful about it. I want to make sure that what we do doesn't create a worse situation than we already have. Thank you, Vadim. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Pastor Hennessy. And I think you, in many ways, summed everything up. You know, we hear a lot of polarization today, and there's got to be some sort of commonality that we can find in something. And this was actually the reason why this dialogue was envisioned, and bring people together, see what that commonality is. I think we've hit on some highlights here. I really do. I think that, you know, a lot of people want perhaps social workers or some other means. They want accountability. They want more outreach. They want people to go in their neighborhood that are non-threatening to be able to solve the problems that perhaps police are not best able to solve. At the same time, you know, say what you will about defunding the police and abolishing the police. There are criminals out there, and as we heard today, there are people out there that will prey on other people, and you need some police response out there. So, you know, Camden and people, places, and this is my own view, but there are places that abolish the police temporarily, and like such as Camden, and the crime rate went up. And what do we do to keep people safe and at the same time make sure that in that safety they're not being preyed upon by both other citizens as well as by police members? And I think we've certainly had a good discussion about that, and I'm glad to capture that to some whatever extent. I appreciate everyone's time today. We are running a little bit late, so I do want to open it up to attendees. If you can raise your hands either in the chat box if you're by phone, *9, and we will get to as many individuals as we can before we have to kind of call it a day at some point in time. But please email us at crc@portlandoregon.gov. We will try to respond to you individually, or at least capture your sentiments as we, you know, try to address some of the issues that have been discussed today. We do want to hear from everybody. So we have 7 hands up right now. I believe Alex Solomon has been waiting the most. Alex.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. So I'm with KBOO News, by the way. So I'm wondering, y'all say that we could basically report police misconduct, and I'm wondering how that's possible, kind of going off of what Sabina said, in the case when cops are kettling, at a protest with their badge numbers very, very small compared to how they usually are, and their names covered. So I actually was within 3 feet of a police officer at one point. I measured basically to see how close I would have to get in order to read the badge number, asked for his name, and he said that I could just read his badge number. As I was trying to take it down, the police began to kettle and I had to leave, so I didn't get the full number. So I'm wondering how realistic y'all think it is for us to report misconduct, especially when we're on the ground like that.
And let me maybe have Ross answer that question. Do we have investigators that are capable of addressing those issues, and how will be the best way to present things if somebody wishes to file a complaint such that it'll be addressed accordingly?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of instances where even before police were covering their name tags, it's very difficult in the protest for community members to identify a police officer because it can be a crowded, confusing situation. Our investigators are pretty good at being able to identify officers nonetheless. So if you do have a complaint, even if you can't get the officer's name, I would definitely encourage you to send that in to us. We're able to get GPS from their vehicles, which again, in a protest, creates other challenges. But if it was a roadside stop or a different situation, we're able to use GPS. We also have access to the police reports from the protest, so we can tell which teams were where. And then we can, through the interview process and through video and through kind of anything we can get our hands on, we've actually got pretty good at identifying officers. Covering up the name tags is problematic, and it's something that we are concerned about and that we're talking to the police bureau and the mayor's office about. But we still have a fairly high success rate. We can't get it every time, but I would encourage you to continue to file complaints. And if you can include anything that's as specific as kind of time and location, that's very, very helpful to us, because we are often able to see where officers were at certain times. And sometimes we can find other videos that other people took, and that helps us identify quite a bit.
Thank you, Ross. And then
Vadim, this is Chief Lavelle. I just want to add to that. We, and I think it was Candace, actually, last time I met with CRC, who brought up the name tag issue. So we have actually ordered all officers a new name tape with their personnel number, which is in the same font and the same size as their previous name tapes. And in the meantime, those are going to take a little while to get printed up and delivered. But then in the meantime, we've got label tape that has large font contrasting view of their personnel numbers as well. So that is being addressed. Thank you, Candace. And I think that was also something Commissioner Hardesty and I spoke about. I think that was in her letter to me. So
thank you, Chief.
Next for the update, I was going to ask you about that. So thanks for that update. And just one quick follow up on that. I've heard that people struggle with being able to align a number with a name. What is that process going to look like? Are people going to be able to receive immediately that information of who that person is, or what do they need to go through to get that?
So those numbers are tied to officers. So like IPR, if you have the number, they can match it with the name. We can match it with the name internally also. That's people's personnel number. We had to remove the names because people were getting threats and getting people were Googling them literally online while they're working and sending them threats and things of that nature. So we switched to the number, but the number is trackable back to an officer.
Thank you again. Next we have Raindrop Works.
Yes, 1 second. Yeah, this is Heather Van Wilde with Raindrop Works. In a similar vein to the question that we just addressed, in these protests, we know that Portland Police has been working with other units such as Multnomah County Sheriffs and other nearby police departments, as well as Oregon State Police. From my understanding, IPR is not able to process complaints against officers that are not part of the Portland Police Bureau, but, and I had this as an instance when I was reporting on the 4th of July, I had an officer who harassed me in violation of the TRO in Woodstock, but they refused to give me their BHR number. I could not see any identification. I couldn't tell who they were assigned through. So my question is, what is the process for us going forward to be able to not only identify who the Portland police officers are, but who are the ones who are not Portland police and who are they working for?
I can take a crack at that if you want, Vadim.
Thanks, Ross.
Yeah, so there are a lot of law enforcement agencies, especially in downtown Portland right now, and especially when they're wearing riot gear, it can be very hard to tell them apart. So if you don't know who the officer is, I would encourage you to report to IPR. If we determine that it's someone like Multnomah County Sheriff's Office or Gresham or something like that, we can forward those complaints over to them. They do not have a civilian oversight system, only PPP does. And we are, you know, IPR is a creature of city code. So any authority we have to investigate is limited to Portland Police Bureau officers. You know, I think everybody's probably seen the video of the federal officer who fired I don't know if it was a rubber bullet or a foam tip bullet at the guy holding the jukebox over his head over the weekend. You know, that's horrific, and that's not something that we have any jurisdiction over or the ability to look into. I am kind of curious to see if in this greater conversation about police accountability, you know, if something comes up that is a discussion around changing that. But for now, I think, you know, for example, Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, you can file a complaint with them, but there's not a civilian oversight body that's independent of Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. It would go through, I think, kind of their equivalent of internal affairs. You can file a complaint, but I can't really speak to how that process works.
If I might be able to follow up then, maybe another question would be asked, why, if they're working under Portland police policies as part of protest, why are they not being held to Portland police policies and procedures?
Portland police doesn't actually have, and Chief Lavelle could probably answer this better than I could, but they don't have any authority to make any of those officers do anything. I think if you have Gresham or Clackamas County Sheriff's Office or something like that working with them, they are supposed to follow the direction for, I think, where they are. But for example, the federal officers, they're completely under their own command. Multnomah County Sheriff has jurisdiction in Multnomah County, so they're able to kind of do what they want to do in Portland without having to connect up to PPB any further than they normally do. So, you know, they're not responsible to the directives that Portland Police Bureau have in the same way that Portland police officers are. So it is a really complicated situation. We released a policy review a few months back about the police on transit, which has now been defunded, I believe, by city council. But, you know, even just on TriMet, I think it was confusing for people to figure out which officer worked for which law enforcement agency. And then if you, you know, have an interaction with the Portland Police Bureau member that you don't like, you can report to IPR. But if it's somebody from Gresham, you can't. And so there's a lot of inconsistent stuff based on the way that Portland City Council has decided to do things and in other places. And I don't think there's a good answer for that at the moment. That's kind of where we are right now. This larger conversation about overall accountability, because you can have accountability for Portland Police Bureau and you can adjust that in whichever way you want, but that's not going to achieve accountability for all law enforcement officers that are operating within Portland, even when we're not in a situation where we have protests happening every night.
Thank you, Ross. And next is, Mr. Nam, Hamnam.
Yes, hi. So I want to ask Chief Lavelle and Mr. Daryl Turner that if you are going to say that the Portland police are going to, you know, protect us and do good policing, then are you willing to change the police contract so that we can actually discipline and fire police for misconduct and also stop having the city pay for their misconduct? The Office of Management Finance insures the police. They pay out settlements almost every single week. If you are willing to say that police will be responsible, will you be financially responsible as the police union with your pension or whatever, so that we don't have to pay for their misconduct? Because right now they get to brutalize people and they earn free extra paid vacations. So if you're going to say that they're going to be responsible, show it by being fiscally responsible.
All right. Would either Mr. Turner or Chief Lavelle like to address that?
As for civil lawsuits that are filed against the city, city attorney's office and the city take the lead on those. We don't, the union does not weigh in at all on any civil actions taken against the city. So that is 100% up to the city attorney's office in the city on how they handle those cases and not up to the police union.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. And I do believe that there's a bill that was introduced in the United States Congress. It is a federal issue with respect to the qualified immunity because the Supreme Court held that it applies to police officers and what standard is applied. I think for those individuals that want to see accountability with respect to qualified immunity, please contact your representatives out there. I'm not sure that's something that the police union or the city can do, as far as I understand the law, at least, kind of summarize what Congress is doing, but I think that's where the movement is right now. Next is CMAB with CARE Oregon.
All right. Greetings. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. This question is for Daryl Turner. Will PPA make the bargaining meetings open to the public, and why not?
So the bargaining meetings at whatever venue the city has are open to the public. The ones at the PPA or that are at our venue are not public. And that is a compromise that we made in a collaborative conversation with the city.
Thank you. I have heard that being floated in various avenues. It's been discussed for a while now, and I don't want to put words into Commissioner Hardesty's mouth or the mayor's mouth, but I think that that's been discussed at those levels. I'm not sure where that is at that point in time, but once again, that's a city negotiation issue, and please contact either Commissioner Hardesty or the mayor with respect to that. I do think that there's been some pushback on having that be a little bit more open. I apologize to everyone if I'm a little bit wrong on that, but I have heard about that.
And I will tell you that before my tenure as PPA president, they were never open to bargaining meetings. And so we believe that there is relevance and importance that a community be involved. So we came to that collaborative agreement based on that anytime it's in a city's venue, people from the community were going to be involved and be able to sit in and listen to the negotiations.
Thank you. And then next we have Robert Monroe. I think you're on mute right now, but if you unmute, please feel free to ask a question or make a comment.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
So my question is for Chuck Lavelle. So day after day, we see that PPB highlights counter-protester voices. They give factually wrong information about the damages downtown. They continuously push this bad protester narrative, which has historically been, known to discredit genuine civil rights movements. And in a recent OPB interview, Joanne Hardesty said that Chuck does not believe police have made any missteps in handling the protests. So my question is, how are we to believe that police are here to reach a peaceful outcome or hold any officers accountable for hours and hours of violence that they've inflicted upon the people that they're supposed to serve and protect?
Well, I don't know if that's actually what I said to Commissioner Hardesty.
You know, we've had 40-something straight days of demonstrations, sometimes violent demonstrations downtown. In that period of time, are there going to be instances where officers have misstepped or done things they're not supposed to? I'm sure there are. But until we investigate and look at those individually, and like Ross Caldwell said, there are 50-something complaints right now with IPR. I mean, there's a process to look at these things, and to come out off the bat and say, well, you know, officers did this or didn't do this without information just wouldn't be prudent on my part. But we're not perfect. We've been out there doing the best we can every night under tough conditions. And I'm sure when this is all said and done, there will be some instances where we find officers did things they shouldn't have done, and we have systems of accountability in place to hold them accountable. And I think, you know, as far as numbers and protest information, I don't know exactly what those numbers are. We get numbers from places. We use them. Those numbers change. They go up or down. So I think it's not anything that's done maliciously or in bad faith, but we're trying to estimate to give people some context about what's going on downtown. And, you know, once we get a chance to look at all these incidents, we'll review them and see what we can do better, and we'll make changes as appropriate.
Thank you. Next we have Brian Betcone. Sorry if I mispronounced your last name. You're on mute if you would like to. There you go.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. Would the Police Bureau please implement significantly larger and permanent identification numbers on the front, back, and pant leg of all officers on duty so as to better hold officers accountable to my black and brown friends? As it is easier to see the name of the checker at the grocery store than the number of an officer carrying a lethal weapon. My understanding is that the new ones will remain the same size, and I demand that they be much larger and also on the back and pant leg. Please make this change to protect my black and brown friends. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Okay. I think to some extent that question has been answered, but I do, I hope it is considered down the road. I think we're hearing that a lot in people who have complaints against the police bureau and what's happening downtown. They're having some difficulty reporting individuals. You know, I suppose that there's different ways around it, but certainly helping in some ways to identify police officers would assist with that. Sam, I'm sorry to kind of move along here, but we're over time a little bit, so I'm gonna try to get the next three people. I appreciate everyone staying over a little bit. And then once again, please email crc@portlandoregon.gov with any other thoughts you might have. And if we can't address them right now, we'll do our best in the near future to respond or routed to individuals that can respond. Next is
real quick, Vadim, was that question posed to someone specific that can answer that, or I just want to make sure that was addressed? It sounded like you answered it, but was that something that someone else would like to answer?
Okay, maybe they do it. So just stay here just in case.
Okay. I'm just making sure that was addressed, because I'm assuming they were directing that at the chief, but Chief Lavelle, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I've heard that. I'm not sure exactly how doable that is. I get the idea of transparency, but having numbers down the pant leg, front and back, I'm not sure how feasible that is.
But we will note it, and it'll be one of the things that we'll Sam? Sam, you're on mute.
Hi there, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, my name's actually Marlene Aviles Cable, and I am part of the TAC committee, and I just wanted to say how much I appreciated Dr. Hennessy's statement. I joined the TAC committee because I am a Latina woman, and I have had positive and negative experiences with the police. I have volunteered with youth in different capacities, and I am both angered what has occurred, and I'm trying to figure out how we can come together that when people do need help, that we have those proper agencies to help people, whether with mental health crisis, but also who have been the victim of crime, because I have also been the victim of crime here in Portland. And, you know, I love what everyone is doing, that there is a multitude of viewpoints. And I think that's important in figuring out what are the best steps so that all these different types of people can be served, because that is what we need to do. We need to have a community that is all being recognized. So thank you for allowing me to speak.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next is Jadra. Jadra. Perfecting. I think I'm can't see your last name for some reason, but please go ahead.
Got it. You got it. Yes, the there's actually two of us sitting here. But anyway, the what feels like is missing is like acknowledgement that the system itself is allowing all of these officers to continue to act improperly. And like I hear the police chief and the other, the union human whose name I forgot, say that what we need is accountability and we need to hold officers accountable, etc. But we've been trying that for quite a long time and it is not working because we still have all these problems. And we still have, you know, police abusing their positions of power and not having consequences.
Yeah, and we'll kind of speak together. My name is Noah, and the thing that I want to add to that is that like we're in a moment where we can have the conversations that celebrate the opportunity to create a new vision. And what I'm hearing from PPD is that we want to bring in a whole bunch of people from outside our jurisdiction to control and contain the protests here in Portland and have them have no accountability. So no matter what happens, we can say it's not our jurisdiction. Also, we want accountability, but there really isn't anything that we can do. It's policymakers. And I'm wondering why for each of you, there isn't like a great desire to demand that our lawmakers give the PPD what they want. And why isn't PPD demanding from them? If like it feels like we're all Costco employees in a meeting saying, well, it's not something I can do. It's someone above my head, but it isn't. Like the chief of police can demand if it's not your jurisdiction, you can demand that you get the thing that you want for PPD. So why is this stuff not happening?
And Jadra and I'm sorry, sir, what?
Noah.
Can you give maybe an example of things that you've done where you've hit a wall as far as this complaint process or getting people to respond to you? So, I mean, part of this is trying to improve the system or whatever extent it is possible at this point, whatever we can make improvements on. What difficulties have you had so we can kind of get a sense?
Well, I'm really more commenting on like what I'm experiencing from this meeting.
I see.
Which is like the responses that I'm hearing from, and I want to be able to support Chief Lowell. I want PPD to be successful. But when I see and experience for myself that the police are holding themselves as infallible, that creates a narrative of we can do no wrong and there's nothing wrong to be found. And that starting place means that there is no desire for real accountability. So it leaves the rest of us to want to tear the system down. And I don't want to tear the system down. I want to imagine a new way of being. And that is not, and if PPD isn't willing to be at that table and want the imagination, then like, what is the place of PPD at the table?
And not to draw too much of a fine point on this, but what is the accountability that you're searching for? Is it for people to, what would that ideal world be, I guess?
The ideal world, I think, is that we would see a complete shift in how we imagine policing, because we've got, it's not just budget cuts that have taken away from other community safety programs. It's budget priorities that have taken those funds and redirected them somewhere else. And the point of policing is like kind of being lost in all of that. And the, I just lost my train of thought. Oh no.
Yeah.
The, but the, what Noah says is exactly, on point with the, we need a completely different way to view the purpose of policing. So like different training, because what police show up to engagements with is the problem. The things that we are handing them ahead of time, it's not the responsibility of the people who are being pulled over or being stopped for a particular infraction to de-escalate the police. If the police officers are showing up pre-triggered to interactions, there's no way that that can go well or safely for the people that are dealing with it.
Yeah. And not that I have all the answers. In my ideal world, there is no one that is above the law. And if an officer takes someone else's life and they are found to have done that even remotely intentionally, they should be imprisoned. There should be no senator, no councilperson, no police officer, no one should be above the law. Police should be not be responding to someone who's been victimized. Unless there is an active shooter or knife involved, they should be the last people involved. And that's already been said. A lot of things have already been offered.
Thank you, Jader and Noah. I appreciate that. Once again, we're going to review, or I certainly am, and all the recommendations that have been made here, including on the chats, and try to put it all together and see what the path forward is as far as what the Citizen Review Committee can do and the kind of recommendations we can make. So thank you for helping to explain that a little bit. Okay, and so we have one last person with their hands up and then we'll sign off. So next is Talisa and Solomon, and you're on mute right now as well, if you can unmute. Talisa, if you have a comment, you're still on mute, and if you unmute, you can leave a comment with us. All right. Well, thank you very much, everybody. I appreciate everyone's time. I appreciate all the panel members, Tiffany, Reverend Haynes, Pastor Hennessy, Scott Kerman, Chief Lavelle, and Alex Rodriguez. Alex, thanks for joining us last minute. I was glad to hear your voice today. Liz Sauer, Officer Turner, as well as Sabina Ertis and Mark Wells. I want to thank everybody on this as interview committee that's participated today. Jihani, Carol, Shana, and Candace as well. And there might be some other people that are there as well. I think we had a lot of input today. I think we've had a lot of questions and answers. Certainly, as has been mentioned, there's differing sides and differing viewpoints, but I think we all want the same thing, which is accountability, a better policing, and responsive police to citizens' needs. And we will do our best to help move that ball forward to whatever extent we can. Everybody, thank you for sharing your time and sharing your experiences. It's been a pleasure speaking with you today. It really has been. Y'all take care. And everybody on the chat list, thank you so much for spending your time here and providing your input as well. Y'all take care.
Thank you, folks. Just real quick for folks that are asking in the chat, we hope to have more discussions in the future. So please connect with us online so that you can stay in the loop about future community conversations. Thanks for being here. David, do you want to go ahead and stop the recording? And I'm making a copy of the chat right now.